WSHC Shepherdstown, and this is WSHC 89.7 Shepherd University Radio, and this is Interviews 29 for the 8th of May. And today I'm going to be speaking with Mr. Michael Cremo. His website is mcremo.com, the book Forbidden Archaeology. And Mr. Cremo, are you there? Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can hear you. Fine.
Okay, very good. And yes, as I kind of alluded to you just briefly as we spoke, I had an idea. Of course, you know, it was earlier this year. It was the anniversary of Mr. Charles Darwin's, I guess, birthday. And there was a lot of kind of fawning and things like that on the public radio stations. And for some time, I've wanted to try to have a debate on this subject in some form or another. And I have a couple essays from Dr. Fetzer. If you wouldn't mind, I thought maybe I could read through those. They're brief, and maybe just respond to the points as you saw fit. Do you think we could try that? You all right?
Okay, you mean when I feel like saying something, interject, or?
Yes, exactly. I kind of wanted to sort of, in a sense, have a debate on the issue, you know, because it is, of course, you know, with the popular, the accepted curriculum in just about every, I guess, school, public school, this university, of course, included, is that the assumption of the evolutionary situation is the origin of species. And actually, though, your book, well, the book that you co-authored with Richard Thompson, Forbidden Archaeology, in a sense, though, it really does, I think, in a sense, undertake this debate in maybe another tack. Does that make sense? Because you're bringing up evidence of skeletons as we have that are millions, in some senses, even hundreds of millions of years old.
Well, yes. According to the currently accepted theory of evolution, human beings like us appear rather late in the whole process, if you accept that theory. According to what most evolutionists believe today, human beings like ourselves first came into existence about 150,000 years ago. Before that, they say, there were no human beings like us on Earth. There were only more primitive ape-like human ancestors that go under different names like Homo erectus, Neanderthal, Homo habilis, Australopithecus, and so on. And they believe the first ape men like that came into existence about 6 million years ago, and they believe before that there were only primitive apes and monkeys. They believe they can trace the history of life further back to some first primitive single-cell creatures that self-organized from chemicals about 2 or 3 billion years ago on Earth. And they say all the physical evidence supports that idea, but what Richard Thompson and I tried to show in our book Forbidden Archaeology was it's simply not true that all the fossil evidence, all the physical evidence supports that idea, and we chose to concentrate on evidence for the human species because that's what most people are interested in, and it's also claimed to be the best documented case of evolution by some scientists. So we thought, okay, well, let's look at the evidence for the human species, and what we found is that there's a lot of evidence reported in the scientific literature, in the professional scientific literature, from the time of Darwin all the way up to the present that contradicts the Darwinian evolutionary account of human origins that we see in so many textbooks and so many museum displays, so many television programs on PBS and things like that. This evidence takes the form of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints that go back many millions of years, all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And
yes, I remember one selection from your book. There was a footprint, a human footprint, just like one of us today would make. And it was in a strata of rock that was really old. I'm not exactly sure, probably even 100 million, or it was certainly millions. And then, of course, but the way to try to excuse that was, well, this forerunner just happened to have similar feet, but it was another species. But then it's like the point was, well, you know, if the feet were the same then as they are now, then it was probably the same skeletal structure to go with the rest of the foot, you know, I mean.
Right. Well, yes, I think the case that you're, there's several cases, but mm-hmm. I think the one that you're referring to there is the Laetoli footprints.
Okay. Yes.
Which were discovered in 1979, or reported in 1979 to the scientific world by Mary Leakey.
Okay.
And there were dozens of these footprints found at this place called Laetoli in the country of Tanzania in East Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They're found in layers of solidified volcanic ash that are 3,700,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And her original report, which was published in National Geographic magazine, Mary Leakey,
mm-hmm.
said the footprints are indistinguishable from anatomically modern human footprints. And other scientists also agreed with this analysis. Tim White, a very famous paleontologist, said, make no mistake about it, they're like modern human footprints.
Mm-hmm.
Now, being evolutionist, neither Mary Leakey nor Tim White nor any of the other scientists who said the footprints were exactly like modern footprints believed that human beings like us existed 3,700,000 years ago to make those footprints.
Mm-hmm.
So they did come up with this alternative explanation that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, the footprints must have been made by someone, by some type of creature, some type of ape man, who had feet exactly like modern human feet.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's an interesting proposal, but mm-hmm. there isn't any physical evidence, any skeletal evidence to support that idea, because we do have the skeletons of the ape men who existed at that time in Africa. They're called Australopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
And we have foot skeletons of those creatures, and their foot structure is not like that of a modern human being. It's like that of a chimpanzee with
mm-hmm.
very long toes, for
okay.
example,
mm-hmm.
and many other ape-like features.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, I think we're getting off in there a lot of, and we can make examples of a lot of science, is that it's geared more towards supporting a current dogma, which makes it actually resemble religion more than science.
Well, yes, I think that's true, because actually the only creature known to science today that has a foot just like a modern human foot is a human being like us. So
mm-hmm.
what they engaged in what I call a process of knowledge filtering,
mm-hmm.
where they tried to make the facts in front of them fit within
mm-hmm.
their established theories. You called them dogmas, and I think that's a fair characterization of them,
mm-hmm.
and I would say I think it's even stronger than that, because
okay.
in this country it is actually illegal to teach anything other than the evolutionary theories in the
really?
Science curriculum, either in secondary schools or high schools or colleges or universities.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else can be taught. It's a government-enforced monopoly that, although there are scientists who object to the evolution theory, who are
uh-huh.
proposing alternatives, the supporters of that theory have been able to convince the federal judiciary, basically,
mm-hmm.
to agree with their view that only the Darwinian theory of evolution should be taught as an explanation for the origin of species, including the human species, in the science curriculum in schools all over the country. And I think that is a bad idea for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it doesn't reflect the actual realities in the scientific world. There are scientists who do not accept the theory of evolution. There are the intelligent design theorists like Michael Behe and people like that. And there are also various kinds of creationists who are trying to justify their views with scientific evidence. You may not agree with them, but I think as long as they're trying to justify their beliefs with scientific evidence rather than scripture, then I think they have to be considered within the bounds of science.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of alternative ideas out there in the scientific world, and I myself am an example. I'm a member of the World Archaeological Congress. I regularly present papers contradicting the Darwinian theory of evolution at scientific conferences on archaeology and human origins. These papers are sometimes published in peer-reviewed conference proceedings volumes. So within the world of science, there are researchers who are opposing the Darwinian theory of evolution. That's the reality mm-hmm. in the world of science. It's simply not true that 100% of all scientists accept the Darwinian theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, I don't see any reason why that idea should have a government-enforced monopoly mm-hmm. in our education system.
Mm-hmm. By any chance, are you familiar at all with Dr. John Romer?
I am not familiar with him, but I always learn something new every day.
Well, he's an Egyptologist and archaeologist, and I think at some point I'm going to play. In 1988, he did a BBC 4 produced a program. It was, I believe, a 7-part series for TV called Testament, the Bible, and History. It was very interesting. What he did was he went through the Bible stories and comparing them to what is archaeologically available. And overall, I enjoyed it very much. I think at certain points for me, he got a little too Eurocentric. But the one quote that really stuck in my mind that I think I can remember it, and I think it fits for a lot of things, is he said, "For as in history and faith, real truth, insight, is not to be found in bits of information, scientific facts, but in the order and the patterns that you choose to make with them." And now one thing with a little sort of a kind of a debate issue, I thought I would read these essays by, and then of course you respond as you see fit, is Dr. James Fetzer, as a distinguished McKnight University professor emeritus, University of Minnesota. And just briefly, he has published more than 100 articles and reviews and 20 books in the philosophy of science and on the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, and cognitive science. On this webpage, his publications have been divided by area, including special vitae for computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, evolution, and cognition.
Okay.
And he's got, so that's kind of introduced. So I think, well, the reason I said that was I think that his opinions will be fairly well in terms of the mainstream scientific community.
Fairly representative.
Yes. So here's the it's a brief, a couple brief essays. Here's the first one. Evolution versus Ideology, Why Intelligent Design Just Won't Do, James H. Fetzer. Recent praise for the doctrine known as intelligent design as a candidate for inclusion in the public school science curriculum raises philosophical questions about the nature of science that I deal with in my courses on science and pseudoscience. The issue is less the nature of religion than it is the nature of science. Intelligent design is not science and therefore does not belong in the science curriculum, but it might nevertheless serve as an important function in distinguishing science from non-science. The aim of science is the discovery of what are known as laws of nature, including the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, and the laws of biology. These laws are the basis for scientific explanations and predictions. If water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, that provides a premise for predicting that when water reaches that temperature, it will freeze, and when it does freeze, together with information that the temperature hit 32 degrees, can explain why. Laws are the core of science.
I would ask the professor, what similar law does the theory of evolution involve?
Mm.
What prediction can you make that if you put certain chemicals together
mm-hmm.
in a certain environment, what predictions can you make about that? What if you want to explain the origin of life, the origin of species in terms of genetic mutations and the effect that they have on an organism, where are the scientific laws that predict? What are the effects of what are the predictable effects of random mutations in an organism's genome, what are the predictable effects on the physiology of that organism? And I don't mean vague speculation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, just like you said, water freezes at 32 degrees. Where are the exact predictions that come from the theory of evolution? Mm-hmm. There aren't any.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead.
Okay. The complexity of the human eye invites an explanation on the basis of laws of biology together with information about the specific conditions that have occurred during the course of history. These laws include a set of at least 8 causal mechanisms, not only genetic mutation and natural selection, but genetic drift, sexual reproduction, sexual selection, group selection, artificial selection, and genetic engineering, 4 enhanced genetic diversity, and 4 determine which genes are perpetuated through time. Suppose, for example, a kind of black algae had acquired land motility and a single light-sensitive cell. If that's a lot to assume. If that sensitivity was adaptively advantageous, it is rather easy to imagine that mutations of more light-sensitive cells in various formations could rapidly evolve as the effect of natural selection. Over millions of years, the result might look like the product of intelligence.
Well, let me stop right there.
Sure.
What he's saying is very significant. He's claiming to represent science, but he's using the words imagination,
exactly.
Speculate. There's nothing scientific there at all.
Mm-hmm.
If he wanted to actually put what he's talking about, the origin of the well-developed mammalian or human eye, on a scientific basis, a strictly scientific basis, what he should be able to do is specify the genetic structure of that very ancient bacteria,
mm-hmm.
With the light-sensitive spot. Then he should be able to specify exactly what change
mm-hmm.
took place in the genetic structure of that primitive bacterium that led towards a more extensive or developed kind of light-sensitive spot.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, he would have to explain how that development contributed to the survival of that bacterium in a particular environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes even... But if we're just talking about a light-sensitive spot, which may be made of a certain number of, you can't even say cells,
mm-hmm.
but because we're just talking about a single-celled organism,
mm-hmm.
you have to first explain how you go from a single bacterium to multicellular organisms.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole big leap of faith right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to trying to explain how all the complex features of the modern human eye developed, and not just the human eye, we would need to explain the origin of the neuronal structures in the brain that are capable of
mm.
receiving a signal from the eye through
mm-hmm.
the optic nerve and converting it into a full-color, real-time moving display of the kind we observe every
mm-hmm.
day. So what you would have to do to put this on a strictly scientific basis would... You'd have to give the series of genetic changes that took place in the history of a developing line of organisms over
mm-hmm.
many, many, many millions and millions of years, and explaining how each one of those genetic changes led to the next step towards a more developed eye. And you can find no such detail explanation in any biology textbook.
Mm.
You can find it in no scientific publication, no collection of scientific publications. All you find are the vague, speculative types of expressions that Dr. Fetzer used.
Mm-hmm.
We can easily imagine how. We can speculate that. You can.
Mm-hmm.
If you have absolute faith in the Darwinian theory of evolution and its mechanisms,
mm-hmm.
but if you don't have that sort of faith, if you're a little bit skeptical, then it's not going to be so easy to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be so easy to speculate about. if you want hard scientific evidence, you're not going to find any for it. So, and when I speak of scientific evidence, I mean the kind of evidence that the theory of evolution in its present form currently demands, because it's a genetic theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just as in Darwin's day, they could speculate that living things were sort of like plastic, rubbery sorts
mm-hmm.
of things that you could easily mold and transform. They're actually very complex biomolecular machinery involved at every level
of
an organism.
That was exactly what I was thinking of in terms of, I'm not sure, but I think that they thought during Darwin's times that either genes were just sort of simple bags of chemicals, or maybe just maybe cells.
Darwin didn't have the concept of genes.
Okay.
That came later with Mendel.
Okay.
Maybe
it was the cells then.
Cells.
Yes, and then that reminded me of, I saw this diagram of a cell, and where it's basically almost like a small city where all of these different things are going on that are interdependent, and you can't really take one thing out of that process and have it work. So I guess the point would be, you know, how does this intricately working machine just sort of, you know, okay, what's my point? I'm saying is that, you know, how did it come to be? Because the idea is that it came from something less. You know, I guess maybe there's the primordial soup, and it's hit by some lightning, and then suddenly it starts stirring around, and then something's living. So, but the thing is, how do you explain the cell? Am I making that point right? How do you explain the cell when, as it's formed now, where it couldn't work without any of its little parts?
Well, I think what you're talking about there is this feature of organisms called irreducible complexity.
Oh, okay.
If you have a very complex bit of machinery, in many cases, if you take one part of the machine away, it won't work. It simply won't work.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're speculating that somehow or other this complex machinery arose step by step, and if you just have, you know, part of a machine, a rotary engine, for example, it's not going to do anything. It's not going to contribute to any function. It's only when you have all the pieces together that they actually perform the function
mm-hmm.
of that.
Yeah.
And to say, well, as many do, that, well, perhaps there were other functions that were later modified, well, that doesn't solve your problem. It just makes it more complex.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you have to explain, it really doesn't solve the problem. It just makes the problem even more complex and even more difficult to explain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I guess I can continue here, although really I think you've already answered some of these points already, but let me just...
Keep going.
Okay.
I'd like to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, so we did the black algae thing. Okay. Over millions of years, the result might look like the product of intelligent design, but it would be the outcome of purely causal processes. Indeed, the point of evolutionary theory is to explain phenomena without having to appeal to intelligence or divine design.
Who said that? Where's the law? Where's the law in the book of science that says that?
Mm-hmm.
That is not really true.
Mm-hmm.
About science. For example, people are very concerned today about genetically modified food,
yes.
For example.
Uh-huh.
And in many countries, they don't allow the importation of genetically modified foods.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the EU, the European Community of Nations, does not allow the importation of genetically modified foods from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they have scientists whose business is to look at samples of food coming from the United States to see if they've been intelligently modified, whether they're natural or whether they contain evidence that their genomic structure has been artificially modified.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, has it been intelligently designed? So we can't say it is an absolute lie, an absolute falsehood, that modern science does not concern itself with intelligence and design.
Hmm.
It does. For example, many people are now concerned about the swine flu and things like that.
Okay.
Now, some people, you don't see this stated very often, but
mm-hmm.
the United States government, other governments, are very concerned that terrorists may be using biological weapons. They may be using artificially modified viruses and bacteria to spread diseases that could not be cured very easily by our current methods. So, the United States military and other militaries around the world have scientists whose specific duty it is to investigate these things, look at viruses, look at bacteria, biological agents, and see whether they have been artificially modified. In other words, they are trying to detect signs of intelligence and design to determine, to distinguish whether these are natural, ordinary viruses or bacteria, or whether they've been artificially modified in some intelligent way to make them more destructive and damaging. So, to say, and then there's the whole science of cryptography, sorting through what appears to be random electronic noise, looking for patterns, intelligent patterns that may indicate some kind of code that could be broken. To say that science does not concern itself with intelligence and design is an absolute falsehood. Now, some might say, well, but we're talking about supernatural intelligence and design. Well, even there, it's simply not true that scientists do not bring what we can put the word God, let's use the God word, they don't introduce the idea of God into their scientific work. Charles Darwin did it extensively.
Really?
The actual question that Charles Darwin was trying to answer in his book, The Origin of Species, was this: did God create each species separately? This is an idea called special creation, and it was actually the dominant idea in the scientific world at his time in England. There were biology professors, geology professors, zoology professors in English universities who were promoting that idea, and he was saying, Darwin was trying to say, well, did God create each of the millions of species separately, or did he create one or two in the beginning and let the rest evolve? So in his book, Origin of Species, he answers that question, and he answers it in the following way. He says there's grandeur in this view of life with the Creator, with a capital C, breathing life first into one or a few forms, and that from such a simple beginning, this whole beautiful variety of species has come. So he uses that word in his book, The Origin of the Species, Creator, with a capital C.
Really?
So his answer to the question he was trying to answer was, in the beginning, God, the Creator, created one or a few living things, and then let the rest evolve. By design, you could say. So if you want to say that we have to eliminate from the science curriculum any scientist or any scientific theory that involves some idea of some supernatural intelligence being involved in the theory or the study, then the first person we should remove from the science curriculum is Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution.
So this
idea that Professor Fetzer is promoting, first of all, it's incorrect in terms of what science does today, and in terms of the history of science, it is also incorrect. Now, it's a decision that can be made that, yes, you could look at science as a game, and you could establish a set of rules for it. So the rules can be very arbitrary. You could make, yes, you could make an arbitrary rule. Yes, we're not going to look at supernatural causation or higher intelligence and design in our study of life or our study of the origin of the universe. But here's something. Either it's true or it's not true that there was some higher intelligence involved in the origin of species. And if you define science in such a way that you rule out that possibility in advance, then your science may not be dealing with everything that is possibly true about the world we live in. And I believe science should deal with everything that is possibly true about the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. I don't think there should be arbitrary rules of the kind that Dr. Fetzer is trying to impose on everyone. I believe those sorts of decisions should be up to individual scientists to make. That I think that is the best way to proceed. If some individual scientist believes that, yes, when I look at the natural world, when I look at the species in front of me, when I look at the complexity of their biomolecular structure, I would propose that, yes, there must be some kind of higher intelligence involved, because the natural causes that I'm familiar with could not bring about such complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wouldn't say that that view should be imposed on all other scientists. I think it should be all right if another scientist says, no, I think natural laws and forces can explain the complexity we observe. I think that's perfectly legitimate. But I don't think that scientist has the right to impose that view on all other scientists. That's when I think scientists become a little bit dogmatic.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about what we might call scientism, rather than science.
Yes. Okay, well, it's just about kind of getting halfway through this first one. It's a theories of evolution resort to different combinations of these mechanisms where accounting for the evolution of a species appears to require invoking them all. That human species has evolved from earlier species becomes apparent from the discovery of our ancestors, including Australopithecus, Java man, Peking man, Neanderthal man, and Cro-Magnon man. None of them was as well adapted to the environment as Homo sapiens. Only evolution has the capacity to account for them. God explains nothing. Moreover, it
turns... Well, first of all,
uh-huh.
We see that every day engineers are working to make machines function better in the environments in which they have to function.
Mm-hmm.
So it is absolutely untrue that an intelligent being could not design biological machines to function better or in a different way in different environments.
Mm-hmm.
Every day at your university, there are engineers and biochemists and others working to do exactly that. Make drugs or machines that will function better in the particular environments in which they have to function.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, if in the military this is done all the time. You know, for example, if an army has to fight in a very extreme environment, like a very hot desert, then its equipment, its machinery, its weapons have to be modified to function in that environment. And how is it done? Do the soldiers just wait to have the weapons evolve in their hands? Or do they say, we need, you know, there's too much sand here. It's getting into the mechanisms of our weapons. We need to do something about this. Then the weapons developers, they'll respond to the environmental demands of that situation, and they'll produce weapons or other kinds of machines that will function better in the environment. And actually, it's very hard to see how this could happen without such intelligent intervention.
So,
I'm just going to have to... I respect Dr. Fetzer. It's right to try to explain everything in terms of natural laws and without any kind of intelligence being involved. If he wants to do that, that's fine. I believe in intellectual freedom. I believe in freedom of scientific inquiry. I believe scientists should follow, they should proposed theories, which to them best explain the evidence. I perfectly accept that. But I don't think Dr. Fetzer has a right to impose his views,
mm-hmm.
although they may be the majority views,
mm-hmm.
no doubt about it, today within the world of science, the theory of evolution and its supporting ideas are the dominant ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I would say probably over 90% of the scientists currently working today support those ideas,
mm-hmm.
and I respect their right to do that. What I don't agree with is using their majority influence to exclude other ideas that are present within the world of science,
mm-hmm.
from the science curriculum and the scientific institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would propose as a practical solution to this problem is this. Let's say 95% of the biologists working today accept the theory of evolution. So I think in the biology textbooks, in the public tax-supported schools, the theory of evolution that they accept should be given 95% of the classroom time in the textbook pages.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be the fair thing to do. But I think in the remaining 5%, of the pages, there should be some objective, neutral presentation of the views of those who are proposing alternatives, who are objecting to the theory of evolution,
mm-hmm.
and then let students make up their own minds about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be much better than the current system of completely excluding the alternatives and the objections
mm-hmm.
from the science curriculum. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, completely excluding the alternatives doesn't reflect the realities in the scientific world today.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Behe, one of the major proponents of the theory of intelligent design, is a professional scientist. He's a professor of science at a university here in the United States in Pennsylvania. He's just as much a scientist as Dr. Fetzer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Fetzer's a philosopher of science, but
mm-hmm.
he's just as qualified to express a view as Dr. Fetzer or any of the other supporters of the theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not that his views are isolated. I've seen Gallup surveys that over 40% of the American people think that views of scientists like Dr. Behe related to intelligent design should be part of the science curriculum. And so I think the idea that I'm proposing, that the alternatives to the Darwinian theory of evolution should be present in a minority of the textbook pages and classroom time, proportionate to the representation of these views within the scientific world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good idea because that is the actual reality.
Mm-hmm.
And a second reason why I think this would be a good idea is that it respects academic freedom and
mm-hmm.
intellectual freedom. Many scientists today, they like to talk about Galileo. You know, they say, all right, you know, hundreds of years ago there was this brave scientist, Galileo. He had a different idea about the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
But the church...
The bishops came after him.
Because yeah. of their influence, their political influence, they were able to suppress his views, put him on trial, and in that way maintain their view. But now, today, that we have this majority of scientists who support the theory of evolution having a lot of political influence, they're using their political influence with the federal judiciary to suppress the views of their scientific colleagues who have different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, now that they're in the same position that the church was in, you know, the big church, mm-hmm. Catholic Church, was several mm-hmm. centuries ago, they're using their influence the same way to suppress alternative views.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I'm proposing is not that radical. Let these alternative views be represented in a small percentage, I would say 5%, you might say 3% or 2% of the textbook pages in biology in the official science curriculum. Now here I'm talking about tax-supported public schools. I think if someone wants to set up a private school, you know, if the evolutionists want to set up their own private schools and teach only evolution, okay, fine. If Christian creationists want to set up their own independent schools and teach their ideas only, that's fine. If supporters of intelligent design want to set up their own private schools, take no tax money, they could just teach their own ideas. But I think if we're talking about a democratic society where the government is taking tax money from all of the people, I think there's an obligation to represent the diversity of views that is actually there in the scientific world and among the general public. Now, I mentioned that among scientists, the supporters of the theory of evolution have a big majority. I would say 95%, maybe even more, support the Darwinian theory of evolution. But among the general public, it's a little bit different story. There have been Gallup surveys done showing that 80% of the American people do not accept the Darwinian theory of evolution as it is taught by its scientific supporters in the education system. About 50% of the American people believe that God created human beings as they are now in the beginning along with the other species. 50% of the American people actually believe that. There's about 30% who think, yes, there was evolution, but God guided it so as to produce human beings. And of course, most scientists don't accept that. They think it's an unguided process. It's a random process. Stephen Jay Gould, one of the major supporters of the theory of evolution, said, well, if you ran the tape of evolution again, you wouldn't get human beings. It'd be very unlikely that you'd get the same series of millions of genetic mutations that would lead to human beings. So as far as evolution is concerned, human beings are a complete accident. It could just as well have been cockroaches ruling the earth. Nothing special about human beings. No predestination there. No, it's just an accident of evolution that we have human beings like us with our ideas of God and all that. So there are 30% of the, 50% of the people are support some version of creationism. 30% believe in some kind of theistic evolution, guided evolution. Only 10% of the American people actually accept the Darwinian theory of evolution as it's taught by scientists in the classrooms. And 10% just don't care.
Exactly.
So maybe they're the wisest of all. Who knows?
Exactly. Okay, well, you do a little bit more here. Evolution versus ideology. Why intelligent design just want to do James H. Fetzer. Let's see, he just said God explains nothing. Moreover, it turns out that we share some 98% of our genes with chimpanzees. This does not...
Okay. Okay, let's look at that. Now, what does a gene do? All that a gene does is it tells a cell how to make a protein.
Okay.
In other words, genes tell cells how to manufacture proteins. Proteins are the building blocks of life, you could say, of our bodies. So it's not a surprise that a chimpanzee would have genes 98% the same as a human being, because we look pretty similar. We're made of pretty much the same stuff. So what it means is that human beings have the same kinds of proteins that you would find in a chimpanzee. But that is no proof of evolution at all. For example, you could find two kinds of cars. You could find maybe a Hummer and a Toyota, you know, standing out in the street. They're made of 98% of the same materials. The same rubber, the same plastic, the same steel, the same, but they were separately designed and manufactured. So the question, what something is made out of, really doesn't tell you how the structure actually came about.
Hmm.
This is one of these standard things that evolutionists say that actually make no sense at all for anyone who knows anything about what a gene really does. It just tells a cell how to string amino acids together to produce a protein. That's all.
Okay. He says, this does not guarantee that we are genetically related, but it is powerful evidence that points in that direction. Small differences in genes can make considerable differences.
Look at what he says there.
Yes.
I mean, this is... first of all, he admits there's no proof that we're genetically related.
Uh-huh.
But then he goes on to behave, express himself, as if we are related.
Uh-huh.
And we're not just related, we're related in the way he says. It is, I think, this kind of slippery use of language, slippery, contradictory use of language, is typical of what evolutionists are forced to resort to, because there really isn't a lot of scientific evidence that supports what they say.
Mm-hmm.
They have to resort to such tricks. You know, they use some scientific word like genes. All right. Everybody has a lot of respect for molecular biologists and geneticists. Genes, yes, that sounds very scientific.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a word like 98% similar. Well, yes, that sounds significant some way. But he says directly, this does not demonstrate or prove any genetic connection. But then, in a very slippery way, he goes around to suggest, well, that it really is true, even though I just said it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of thing is sadly typical of the kinds of twisted use of language that evolutionists routinely engage in.
Well, it's just another ideology, I guess. That his title, Evolution versus Ideology, I mean, in a sense, that's, he's kind of name-calling here. It just depends on your point of ideology, I mean.
Well, see, now one thing I want to make clear is I believe Professor Fetzer has a right to be an evolutionist, has a right to believe that evolution is the best explanation for the origin of species. What I don't believe he has a right to do is to try to impose that view on the world of science in such a way that alternative views are suppressed, excluded. I think that interferes with scientific progress. I think that sort of attitude, which is an ideological attitude, really interferes with the progress that science can make.
Okay, we'll see. Small differences in genes can make considerable differences in their manifestations due to the influence of pleiotropic and polygenic effects, where single genes affect multiple traits or combinations of genes affect single traits. How do DNA and skeletal similarities between species, for example, figure in the grand design? Doesn't all of this suggest the operation of the causal mechanisms of evolution of long duration?
It also suggests the operation of intelligence. It may suggest the operation of forces, but it just makes things even more complicated for the evolutionist. If they are going to put their ideas on a scientific level of the type that Dr. Fetzer was speaking of in the beginning, where, you know, chemists, they can tell, well, what will happen. You know, if you put together certain chemicals, they can predict exactly what will happen. Now, if you're going to say that there's cross influence among genes and this and that and the other, you know, well, then if you're going to put your theory on a purely scientific level and not just on the level of speculation, imagining things, what might happen, the suggestion, and, you know, then you would have to be able to explain, well, what is the mechanism by which this gene is able to influence other genes throughout the genome, and what is the nature of their combined influence on a biomolecular level, and what effect does it have? As I said, all that a gene really does is tell a cell how to string amino acids together to make a protein.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have to explain, because every cell in an organism, like a human being, has the exact same DNA in it. You know, we get our DNA from our father and mother. It's and then that fertilized egg begins to split.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And each cell that results from that splitting has the exact same DNA in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fully formed human being has trillions of cells organized in very complex structures,
mm-hmm.
organic structures like the eye, the heart, the brain. There's so many different tissues. There's blood. There's different layers of skin. There are different kinds of muscles. So if every cell has the exact same DNA in it, then how does any particular cell know, well, I'm going to be a brain cell,
mm-hmm.
you know, that after a million divisions, you know, like I'm split off from this cell, I split off from that one, split, how does it know it's going to be a brain cell?
Mm-hmm.
Or how does it know it's going to be a cell in the retina of my eye? Or how does it know it's going to be a muscle cell in the heart?
Mm-hmm.
There are trillions of these cells.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to put the theory of evolution on a purely scientific basis, you would have to explain, you make some change in the genetic structure of a cell, but which cell?
Mm-hmm.
Which cell do you make? There are trillions of cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd have to explain, well, what effect does that change have? It means the cell is going to produce a certain protein, but when? At what stage of this whole cell division process will that protein be produced?
Mm-hmm.
And then what effect will the production of that protein have further on down in the cell division process that's going on among trillions of cells in this complex organism? What effect is it going to have on the developing structure? You can't find any such detailed explanations. All you can find is the kind of language that Professor Fetzer uses. We could imagine that. We could speculate that. But others may speculate in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Professor Fetzer has the right to say that we can only speculate or imagine in the way that he does.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a kind of intellectual dictatorship that
uh-huh.
he's trying to impose
uh-huh.
on all other scientists and the whole education system.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think that should be allowed in a democratic society.
Mm. Well, here's the next thought. Morphological similarities, DNA comparisons, the fossil record, and geological evidence all support the general conception of an Earth that is around 5 billion years old, where life emerged around 600 million years ago, and hominid life around 5 million years ago. Appeals to an unknowable source using unspecified means does nothing to fill any gaps in our knowledge. It merely substitutes pretense for what we don't know, ignorance that in the past has commonly proven to be temporary.
Well, let's look at some of the things that he's saying there.
Okay.
Saying morphological similarities. What he's implying is that morphological similarity implies evolution.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you can go out on the street, you can see two-wheeled bicycles,
mm-hmm.
motorcycles with two wheels.
Okay.
Sometimes you can see vehicles with, in parks and things like that, where they have different kinds of leaf blowers and things like that with three wheels.
Mm.
Then you could find cars with four wheels, and you could find trucks with six wheels, eight wheels, 10 wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think, wow, there's some morphological similarities there. There's some apparent progression. And to some, they think evolution's the only thing that explains that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at how each of those vehicles came into existence. They were all individually designed and individually manufactured. It's not that, you know, it's not that one came from the other in some sort of physical process. Each of those vehicles, despite their morphological similarity and the apparent progression in forms that we observe if we look at a whole range of vehicles, they did not come about by some evolutionary process. Mm-hmm. Each vehicle was separately designed and separately manufactured in a different factory. Mm-hmm. So this, again, is rather sadly typical of the supporters of the theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. You know, they take some feature of reality that could actually have many different explanations, and they impose their explanation as the only real explanation. It's kind of a sleight of hand trick, like a magician will use. Mm-hmm. You distract the person's attention, get them to focus on something, and get them to believe what you're saying. But if you actually think about it, morphological similarities, some apparent progression in forms, can be explained in multiple ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave this example of automobiles and vehicles and of different kinds as a perfect example of this. Now, in terms of biological form, the same thing is there. Yes, the morphological similarities could be the result of evolution from a common ancestor. They can also be the result of common design.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we see that designers, usually they don't invent the wheel every time. They make use of things that have been previous, that are part of a mechanism, and then they go from there. You know, they use the same sorts of things that were present in other mechanisms to design new mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So, morphological similarity could be the result of some evolutionary process. It could also be the result of a designer making use of the same elements as he comes up with variations on different forms. So philosophically speaking, just in terms of the alternatives, you can't really distinguish between them. Now, the evolutionists, if they want to say that their explanation is the right one, they would have to give, you'd have to look at the kinds of mechanisms that they are proposing for change. Basically, their theory is a genetic theory. They say, all right, an animal or any other living thing has a genetic structure. If you modify that genetic structure, you're going to get changes in the physiological structure.
Mm-hmm.
That in essence is the theory of evolution.
Okay, well, let's...
So what they would have to do is, well, explain, well, what was the genetic structure of all these forms? What exact changes did you make or would you make to get the new forms? But you find no such detailed explanation, so they're not able to justify their particular view.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Fetzer also mentioned the fossil record, you know, saying that the first evidence for hominids, ape men, comes into existence about 5 or 6 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Thompson and I wrote the book Forbidden Archaeology to deal with that particular claim, which is a claim that's often made. It's claimed to be based on an objective study of the discoveries that have been made by geologists, paleontologists, archaeologists who've been looking into the layers of the earth, and they give the impression, well, that yes, everything they've discovered supports this idea that first there were some primitive apes and monkeys. Then about 5 or 6 million years ago, we get some kind of ape men coming into existence. And then gradually over time, those ape men develop into human beings like us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just presented as an absolute fact. I mean, everybody's gone to a museum or has seen in a magazine or a textbook, you know, the little tiny monkey getting a little bit bigger, turning into a ape man, and the ape men get bigger and bigger until finally you get a human being like us.
Yes.
But if you actually go, as I did, into the primary scientific literature, by primary scientific literature, I mean original reports published in the professional scientific literature by individual investigators, individual archaeologists, paleontologists, geologists, you will find hundreds of reports published in the scientific literature from the time of Darwin all the way up to the present, showing that scientists have discovered human bones, fully human footprints, artifacts that scientists normally attribute to human beings like us, not to any kind of ape men, in layers of rock millions and millions and millions of years old. So Professor Fetzer's claim is practically everything he said is simply not true.
Okay. WSHC Shepherdstown, this is WSHC Interviews, and we're speaking with Michael Cremo. Please dial up his site is mcremo.com, and the book, well, he's got quite a few things at the site, but principally the Forbidden Archaeology book. It's very interesting. And also, I guess I wanted to point out WSHC Worldwide is 897WSHC.org. And we were also, I was kind of going along through an essay from Dr. Fetzer, James Fetzer, Why Intelligent Design Just Won't Do. We're to the point where it says, for the theory of an intelligent designer to be taken seriously as a scientific theory rather than merely a guess or a conjecture, it must have predictive as well as explanatory significance. Without knowledge of the causal mechanisms used by the intelligent designer, it is not a testable theory. What are the laws that were involved? With knowledge of the causal mechanisms used by the intelligent designer, however, there is no need to invoke the designer itself. Either way, there is no place in science for the intelligent designer hypothesis.
Well, again, simply not true. As I mentioned earlier in the show, scientists every day are using concepts of intelligent design. I mentioned scientists who are looking at food products, for example, to see whether they have been genetically modified. Scientists who are looking at viruses and bacteria that are responsible for different sorts of human diseases, looking to see if the viruses or bacteria may not have been tweaked by some scientist somewhere in the world who is attempting to perhaps infect the world with some diseases that don't have cures. There may be terrorists working on these things. The United States military recognizes this. It already has scientists who examine these viruses and bacteria that are disease agents to see whether they are just natural organisms or whether they have been intelligently modified to produce more virulent effects or evade treatment by our normal kinds of drugs. So it's just simply not true that the idea of intelligent design has no place in science. Detecting design has been part of science for a long time. And all that the current generation of intelligent design theorists have tried to do is just extend the range of that idea to include the origin of certain complex structures within organisms. And I say what they're doing is opening up a whole new field of scientific research. If the exact mechanisms aren't understood, well, scientists should look for those mechanisms. Just like in the theory of evolution, today it's a genetic theory, and but the supporters of the theory of evolution have not been able to demonstrate how any feature of modern organisms, any complex feature of modern organisms, actually arose by some series of genetic mutations. You can find in no biology textbook any detailed genetic explanation of how any complex feature of the organisms that we observe around us originated. So that means, well, they've proposed evolution by natural selection, but they can't explain exactly how it happened. So therefore, that means there's work for scientists to do who believe in that idea. And I say they have a perfect right to do that. But if there are other scientists who are proposing another mechanism, intelligent design, and we can observe intelligent design everywhere around us. You look at any machine around you, we can suppose that it was designed. We can invest. We may not know exactly how it was designed, but all right, there's a whole discipline called reverse engineering, where you know, someone, some scientist in some country, maybe they get some bit of machinery or a vehicle or a military weapon from some other country, and they want to build it themselves. They don't know how to do it, so they engage their scientists in reverse engineering, trying to discover how exactly this was built or designed so they can do it themselves. So I don't see what Professor Fetzer's objecting to that. Well, they don't, the intelligent design theorists haven't been able to explain exactly how this happens. Well, that's what science is about, finding the answers to those questions. If it were, if all the answers were obvious,
there would be
right
no,
in the beginning,
no
well, what would be the need for science at all?
Yes. Well, he's almost done here. It says, indeed, intelligent design is old wine in new bottles as the latest incarnation of what is classically known as the argument from design. It was subjected to a devastating critique by David Hume in the 18th century. A finite and flawed earth suggests a finite and flawed creator. Who knows how many prototypes might have gone before and been discarded? Who knows whether the one we inhabit might even be among them? Who knows how many gods or goddesses might have been involved? Who knows how any of this could possibly have been done? The Catholic Church reconciles science and religion by adopting the position that God created the world and various forms of life using evolution. The mechanisms of evolution thus provide an answer to the questions I have raised. If they are adequate to explain if they are adequate to explain and to predict the course of evolution relative to information about specific events during the world's history, then those laws belong in the scientific curriculum, but not the appeal to God, a hypothesis that is not required. In the absence of specification of the causal mechanisms and laws by which intelligent design is supposed to take place, it cannot qualify as science, but it might still be used as in the biology curriculum to explain the major differences between science and non-science. Religious beliefs, as articles of faith, do not have to satisfy the standards of explanatory power and empirical testability that scientific hypotheses must meet. Our students can benefit from understanding the distinction between them, but we should not substitute ideology for evolution. And that was the James A. Fetzer offers courses on science versus pseudoscience at the University of Minnesota Duluth. So, you know, really, it's the whole thing is just sort of pointing fingers and name calling, really. I mean,
well, yes. Well, first of all, not every philosopher agrees with David Hume's so-called devastating critique.
Okay.
His attempt to say that, well, a flawed world indicates a flawed creator is
what exactly
a negative theological argument. In other words,
my question would be what exactly is flawed about it? It seems to work perfectly to me. If there's any flaws, it's what humans have tried to change and screw up, but you know, I don't know.
That's another way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it may be that God did not design the material world as a perfect place of happiness because we're really not meant to be here forever.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're meant to be at some other level of reality that is perfect. So Dr. Fetzer is using a lot of flawed arguments there. Again, he makes this claim that there are no causal mechanisms. Well, intelligence is a causal mechanism. Without intelligence, without intelligent causes, many of the things that we observe around us would not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Mobile phones would not exist. Automobiles mm-hmm. would not exist. Supermarkets would not exist. Banks wouldn't exist. Political parties wouldn't exist. There is a lot of evidence for intelligent causation. Now, what he objects to is extending the range of that intelligent causation to things that he thinks can be explained totally by natural laws. But where did those natural laws come from?
Hmm.
When astrophysicists look at our universe, they see that the laws of nature, the ratios of various natural forces, and are very finely tuned
mm-hmm.
for life to exist in this universe.
Hmm.
The Royal Astronomer of England, Sir Martin Rees, has written an excellent book called Just Six Numbers,
mm-hmm.
where he looks at six of these natural laws and ratios of natural forces that are very, very finely tuned, such that if you just varied them by the slightest little bit, you would not have life in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's the mass of the electron, the ratio of the mass of the electron to the mass of the proton.
Mm-hmm.
If it were even slightly different than what it is, the value at which it is now recognized as being,
mm-hmm.
then we wouldn't have stable atoms,
mm-hmm.
which means we wouldn't have stars, which mm-hmm. depend on stable atoms mm-hmm. in order to generate their thermonuclear reactions, and then we wouldn't have life. So there are actually hundreds of these ratios of natural forces and natural laws
mm-hmm.
that are very finely tuned to particular values, and there's no reason why these values have to be set the particular way that
mm-hmm.
they're set. It appears, if you want to talk about natural laws and forces, well, where did they come from?
Mm. There's usually, if there's a law, there's usually somebody that...
there's a lawmaker.
There's a lawmaker.
And it appears that our universe is set up like that.
Mm.
So that's one point. And then the other point that he makes is, well, he says, well, if things can be explained according to natural laws, then why invoke some intelligent causation? Well, first of all, where do those natural laws come from? We'll set aside that.
Mm-hmm.
But the theory of evolution does not rise to that level. And as I've pointed out several times in this conversation,
mm-hmm.
you can look in any biology textbook, you will find no detailed causal explanation of how the complex features of organisms have arisen by the processes that the theory of evolution invokes. It's a genetic theory. It's based on the idea that living things have a genetic structure, they have a physical structure.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that the physical structure is to a large extent determined by the genetic structure. If you make changes in the genetic structure, there are changes in the physical structure. So, as I pointed out many times, the supporters of the theory of evolution have not been able to give any detailed explanation based on giving the exact series of genetic changes that took place in the genome of the sequence of living things that they say sequentially existed on Earth, such that they give a series of genetic changes that explains in some detailed scientific way the sequence of physical changes in the bodies of those living things that led to, for example, the human brain, the human eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with Dr. Fetzer that if you can give a complete natural explanation of how something arose in the world, invoking physical causes, physical elements combining according to physical laws, then yes, there may not be any need to invoke an intelligence in that process, although, as I pointed out, you may have to invoke intelligence to explain how those physical laws came to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the evolutionists haven't done that. So intelligent causation remains an option.
Mm-hmm. I believe we spoke, it was probably about 5 years ago, and I have your book here that you co-authored with Richard L. Thompson, Forbidden Archaeology, The Hidden History of the Human Race. And basically, we just kind of went through it, and this is a huge wealth. It's over 900 pages. But my first question was, since this first came out in 1993, have there been any significant finds that would be worthy of maybe adding to the book at some point?
Right now, since the book first came out in 1993, many more cases have come to my attention. There are enough to fill
another
book.
Wow.
So I'm working on that now. Tentatively, I'm calling it Forbidden Archaeology 2.
Okay.
The title under which it's eventually published may be different, but mm-hmm. that's my working title. And I'll just give an example just from this year.
Okay.
Earlier this year, zoologists, paleontologists working in Kenya
mm-hmm.
discovered footprints at a place called Illiret near Lake Turkana in Kenya in Africa.
Illiret.
And these footprints were found in sediments 1.5 million years old. They were able to date the sediments because of the presence of volcanic deposits there. And there's a method called the argon-argon method, or sometimes the potassium-argon method, that could be used to date these volcanic materials. So that's how they were dated.
Mm-hmm.
The scientist who investigated these footprints said they display all the anatomical features of modern human footprints.
Mm-hmm.
So this may remind us of the case that we talked about a little bit earlier, the Laetoli footprints,
mm-hmm.
which were 3,700,000 years old and also modern.
Uh-huh.
So the scientist had to say who made these footprints.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't want to say that human beings like us made the footprints, because according to their theories, human beings like us did not exist
mm-hmm.
a million and a half years ago, because we hadn't evolved yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, that means they had to propose the footprints must have been made by some kind of ape man who had feet,
mm-hmm.
just like modern human feet. So they said, Homo erectus.
Okay.
Because that's the ape man that they believe lived in that part of the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, problem is, nobody's ever discovered any foot skeleton of Homo erectus. They have some bones from other parts of the body, but nobody's ever discovered any foot bones from Homo erectus. So nobody knows
mm-hmm.
what the foot bones of Homo erectus really look like.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the only creature known to science today that we know with absolute certainty that has a foot just like a modern human being is a human being like us, a modern human being. So I think if you're going to proceed in a strictly scientific way, you would have to say, on the basis of the evidence we now have, the only creature that we know today
mm-hmm.
that had a foot capable of making those footprints is a human being like us.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing we can say now, as scientists, operating just on a purely scientific basis, is that perhaps we have to entertain the idea that humans like us have existed for far longer than we used to think possible, based on this evidence. Now, I think that is... But they didn't do that
mm-hmm.
Because that would have messed up their evolutionary progression of hominids leading mm-hmm. up to human beings. It would; they would probably be very afraid, well, this will be ammunition for critics of the theory of evolution. They will point out that, yes, scientists have made a big mistake over the past 30 or 40 years, and... So,
Yes,
so So that's a very recent case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people often ask me, are things like this being discovered, the things that you talk about, are they being discovered today? Yes, they are being discovered, but they get interpreted in such a way that they fit into the current evolutionary picture of human origins without messing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And if people aren't able to see through this, then it seems perfectly reasonable to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at my function as pointing out, well, all right, they want to say those footprints belong to the ape-man Homo erectus, but they have no basis for doing that other than their belief in the theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to proceed in a strictly scientific way, then they would have to say the only creature we know today who has a foot capable of making those footprints is a human being like us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe in the future they'll discover the bones of some ape man that has a foot exactly like a modern human foot.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they'll discover some skeleton of some ape man, a complete skeleton, that would have the foot bones. And they would show the body is like an ape man, the foot is exactly like modern human feet. Then they could say, they could correctly say, well, perhaps this ape man made those footprints because this ape man has feet exactly like modern human feet.
Mm-hmm.
Even that wouldn't clinch it, because it still could have been human beings like us who made those footprints.
Well,
but
yes,
at least they could say as a possibility, yes, we believe this ape man made those footprints.
Hmm. Well, you know, thumbing through your book, Forbidden Archaeology, page 807, it says a shoe sole from Nevada, the Triassic period, partial shoe sole in Triassic rock from Nevada, it says Ballou 1922. The Triassic is dated at about 213 to 248 million years ago. So, you know, shoes.
Yes, that was a discovery that was reported originally by a man named James Reed, R-E-I-D.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, he was a scientist working in, scientist or engineer working in Nevada, and the Ballou article was an article that was published in a newspaper about these discoveries. But it was interesting. He took his specimen. It's like, it's not a footprint. It's like the imprint of the rear part of what appears to be a shoe.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if you look at a shoe, you know, if you turn over a well-made shoe and look at the sole of it, you'll see that the sole of the shoe is sewn to the rest of the shoe, and you can see the threads. And that same feature is visible on this shoe print.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Reed took the photograph to an institution connected with the Rockefeller hospital there in New York, medical center.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that the object was examined using photomicrographic techniques.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they put it under high magnification and were able to photograph the print. And under high magnification, the threads themselves were actually visible. You know, that as they would be visible on the bottom of a modern shoe. So it's quite an interesting discovery, but it is from the Triassic period, which, as stated, as you mentioned, goes back over 200 million years.
Uh-huh. Actually, I have a question from a listener who's listening in England. It says, listening for a bit now, could you ask him about the Star Child skull, in parentheses, Lloyd Pye? How does this fit into the picture of human evolution? And there's a web page, starchildproject.com. Are you familiar with that at all?
Yes, I am. There is a researcher named Lloyd Pye who has in his possession a very unusual skull that comes from South America.
I'm looking at it. What is it? It almost looks like a cross between a, I don't know what.
Well, it has a very bulbous sort of skull structure.
Almost like a cat in a, well, I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't look quite human.
No.
Now, there are cases in various parts of the world where skulls of young children get modified.
Yes.
By flattening or pointing or something like that. But this appears to be something natural, not the result of artificial manipulation of the skull. The proposal that Lloyd Pye is investigating is that perhaps this skull is that of a human alien or extraterrestrial hybrid. Look at how he would try to demonstrate that. How he's trying to demonstrate that is doing genetic studies.
Okay.
They've been able to recover a little bit of the DNA from the bone. The bones are not that old. They're not old, so they're not really dealing with the topic that I'm dealing with, extreme human antiquity. What I've been looking for is evidence that humans have existed on Earth for longer than the current supporters of the theory of evolution imagine.
So this is
he's dealing with a different topic. He's looking at extraterrestrial influences. So
there is a bit of a YouTube, a video. He's holding this skull, and would you maybe mind listening to some of that, or see what he I've never.
I've heard him. If your listeners would like to hear,
I've never.
You could share it with them. Sure.
I've never come across the subject at all. Wait a minute. Let's get this going back at the beginning. Okay.
Yeah, I've heard Lloyd Pye make his presentation, but your listeners may be interested, so go ahead.
Let's see here. Is it going to load? It looks like it's loaded. I might have to
But I think what he's trying to do is demonstrate from the DNA samples that there is something there in the genome that isn't terrestrial.
Hi, I'm Lloyd Pye.
That's extraterrestrial.
This is an exact stereolithographic copy of the famous Starchild skull.
Oh, so this is a copy.
The Starchild skull is a real, true bone skull that was found in Mexico around the Copper Canyon area about 1930. Carbon-14 analysis has shown that it died about 900 years ago. As you can see, it is very different in shape from a typical human skull. But over the last 10 years with the Starchild Project, we've had dozens of experts examine it, and they can come up with no kind of typical human deformity that matches all of the unusual things about this skull. Its unusual physiology begins with the bone itself. It's uniformly half as thick as normal human bone, and it weighs half as much. It's very light by comparison, and yet it's 2 or 3 times as hard. It's extremely durable. We think some of that durability comes from very unusual fibers woven through the matrix of the bone, never seen in any other animal of any kind. There's also a red residue found in the bone in the cancellous holes that is also very unlike any other bone that is known. So you have those unusual attributes right off the bat. Then in the rear, we see that it lacks an inion, which is that knot that we all have in the back rear of our heads. Everybody has that. Chimps have it, gorillas have it, everything has it. And that's where your neck muscles attach. Its neck muscles attach all the way down here, right on top of the foramen magnum, meaning it has a very small neck, like half the size of a normal human neck. And it sits at a different angle. The head sits at a different angle than a normal human head. Very different. Chewing muscles, very much reduced. Normally up here, down here in the Starchild. Very small lower face. Look at these eye sockets. Look how shallow they are. Not even as deep as the first knuckle of my finger. Not even a full inch. In a human being, 2 full inches, all the way up to here, that depth. The eyes themselves are centered down here in the middle of the nose, so that the eyes are down here rather than up at the top like our eyes. Very, very unusual eyes. unusual in so many ways. No sinuses in here. We've had all kinds of testing done over the past 10 years. Not just taking it to experts to get their opinions, but CAT scans, x-rays, scanning electron microscope, everything we could think of, trying to find out what it is, and it all comes back. This is not normal. This is really unusual. So, the main test we've had has been DNA. And what the DNA has told us is remarkable. In 2003, we recovered very easily its mitochondrial DNA, which told us that its mother was human. But in six full attempts, we could not recover its nuclear DNA. And nuclear DNA comes from your mother and your father. And so that told us right away that the father was very unusual and the star child itself is very unusual. Now, during the course of this year, 2009, we're hoping to have a DNA test done that will recover the entire genome of this remarkable relic. And when we get that result in, and we believe that we'll have it by the end of this year, we know that this skull is going to make history as big and as dramatically as history can be made. It's going to prove that at one time on planet Earth 900 years ago in Mexico, an alien human being walked this earth.
Okay, well, Star Child Project. Kind of reminded me in a little bit. Are you familiar with the work of Stephen Greer and the Disclosure Project, or any thoughts on that?
I've met Stephen Greer. I believe he's disclosed evidence for UFOs.
Uh-huh.
And some of the people that have testified at his different disclosure events have included some military officers, scientists, and others.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's another one of those out of bounds topics.
Yes,
that will sometimes inspire more conservative scientists to throw around terms like pseudoscience and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But yes. I'm familiar with the work of Stephen Greer and Lloyd Pye.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, let's see. Your site is rather interesting. mcremo.com, mcremo.com. Now, you do a bit of traveling. You're in Russia. You've had some seminars pretty much all over the world.
Well, my books have been published in 20 languages now,
okay.
And I regularly get invitations to speak at universities and scientific institutions all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to Russia a few times. My most recent visit was last fall,
okay.
In October, November, and early December, and I spoke at universities all over the country and scientific institutions as well,
mm-hmm.
including the Russian Academy of Sciences. It's interesting. There are different reactions to my work from different kinds of scientists because scientists aren't all unified.
Mm-hmm.
They have different views.
Exactly.
So there are some scientists who are, I guess, more or less in the category of Professor Fetzer,
mm-hmm.
who really don't have a lot of patience with mm-hmm. opposition to the theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to hear me speak. They don't want anyone else to hear me speak. But I think they represent a minority. There are, I call them fundamentalist evolutionists, because I believe they accept that theory, not for strictly scientific reasons, but because it confirms their prior belief in atheism and materialism, basically. So for them, it's more of an ideological position, or some people would call it a new religion, a new dogma.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a very powerful minority in the world of science, but they're not the majority. The majority of scientists, I believe, are more open-minded. they accept the theory of evolution for more or less scientific reasons, because they believe it best explains the evidence. But they're open-minded, they're willing to consider alternatives, they're willing to listen to someone who's proposing alternatives in a respectful way. And it is from that group of scientists that I get these invitations to speak at universities and scientific institutions all over the world. I also have, I'm regularly speaking at international conferences on archaeology and history of science and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that and my publications, I've got a bit of a reputation. So I do get these invitations, particularly from countries in which my books have been published in the local language, as in Russia, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's a minority of scientists who actually agree with me. They're not simply open-minded, they actually agree.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they're in a minority now, but that's how these things go.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I've been to Russia a few times. During my previous visit to Russia, I was speaking at one university. Well, I was invited to speak. It was a university in a city in Siberia, in a town called Tumen, which is a huge city. I didn't realize there were huge modern cities all over Siberia. Sort of cities like the size of Dallas and Fort Worth, because it's the oil and gas producing regions of Russia. They're having a huge boom there.
Mm-hmm.
They've got these huge modern cities. So at one of them, there's a university, and some professors at the university had invited me to speak. But at the last moment, because of pressure from outside organizations, the presidents of the university canceled my lecture.
Really?
So the professors who invited me, they went to him, and they said, please, you know, but he said, no, you know, we're not going to let this anti-evolutionist speak at our university.
Mm-hmm.
So the professors then went to the local branch of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and they spoke to the director there. And he said, he can speak here, and nobody will put any pressure on me.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the academic hierarchy in Russia, the Academy of Sciences is actually higher than the university, really.
Uh-huh.
So what they did is they arranged for buses to carry students and professors from the university.
Isn't that something?
And the lecture was just packed, and the professors told me more people came to the lecture that would have come if it had been held at the university as scheduled.
So the
he said everybody on the university was talking about, who is this guy?
Yeah.
What is he going to say that's so dangerous that the president of the university canceled his lecture? So then this past year, when I went again to the same university, I spoke in the biology department of the university, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they decided that trying to ban the ideas just made them more popular. I went back to the same university this year and I spoke there without any problem from the president.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Some interesting things happened. I spoke all over the country, going from the Vladivostok in the Far East to St. Petersburg and Moscow in the West, and all kinds of places in between. It was really an amazing experience.
Oh, and it says you were on the Russia's most popular radio show, 20 million listening in the audience.
Yes, that's true. Radio Mayak.
Mayak.
That means lighthouse.
Really?
It's a very very popular radio show. I was on that.
No knowledge of that. I'll try to look into that. Interesting. You know, one thing, now this is, well, it's still on the subject of your book, I'm almost positive, it's been a long time since I've really tried to go through your book, but it was something about a story of a frog that had been found, was in some type of very old strata of rock, and it was in some type of hibernation, and actually still alive. Isn't that mentioned somewhere in your book?
I don't think that is mentioned in...
I'm not sure where I heard that, though.
Book.
Sorry.
but it's something... I may have mentioned it in some of my writings.
Okay.
But there are some interesting cases. There's not just one case
okay.
like that, but if you, you know, there's a man named Corliss who puts together some interesting, what he calls handbooks about geological mysteries, archaeological mysteries. He calls this whole series of books the Source Book Project. And in the geological mysteries, he mentions many cases. He just basically provides quotes
uh-huh.
from the different literatures that mention these things. And there are cases, many cases, of discoveries of live frogs and ancient, very ancient layers of coal,
mm-hmm.
the Carboniferous period, the main coal period, goes back 300 million years. So,
now, is this
some scientists try to explain these things like,
uh-huh.
well, a frog egg was taken down through some crack into some cavity in the coal,
uh-huh.
and then the frog, you know, there were some nutrients that must have come down in the same way into that cavity, and the frog grew up a little bit, and then he was uncovered, and there he is, alive.
Mm-hmm.
Another explanation is that, and it's the explanation that I actually prefer, is that somehow or other, these frogs went into some state of suspended animation, some
mm-hmm.
kind of hibernation that just lasted for extremely long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's, you know, kind of a side topic with me.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
I'm interested in all kinds of mysteries,
mm-hmm.
and but I've concentrated, you know, in my really serious research in a few areas. I can't investigate everything.
Oh, exactly.
Myself.
It's only so much time.
But that is, there are many cases like that that have been reported from various parts of the world
mm-hmm.
of living frogs being taken from very ancient layers of rock.
Yeah, and it just, now, excuse me, I hope this is not, but I can just vaguely remember an old, I believe it was a Warner Brothers cartoon. I'm not sure what the character was, but that was the theme. This, now, I guess the frog was found in some kind of time capsule or something like that, and it kind of. But it's kind of a similar story. Excuse me for that, but yes, probably about 15 minutes or so left. So you say there's certainly, you're saying even every year we have findings that are equal to the. Contents that in forbidden archaeology, and so pretty soon you have enough that will be an actual part two. It's not really going to be
repeating. Right. Well, I've got a couple hundred of these cases that I'm investigating,
uh-huh.
and
okay.
I really admire authors who can really rush out with books. I'm just not able to do that.
Yeah,
I get a case, I have to look
yeah.
at it, I have to try to document it. I've got
mm-hmm.
to, you know, try to get the any skeptical sorts of objections, look at them and see how well they stand up. So it takes me a while to get these things done. Now, sometimes what I do is I publish individual cases in a column that I write for Atlantis Rising magazine.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. if, you know, so by following that column... And also sometimes I report these things on my website.
Uh-huh.
But, so I'm, now some of the cases are out there, but I've got a couple hundred of them
uh-huh.
That have come to my attention since Forbidden Archaeology was published
mm-hmm.
that I've been investigating and will publish in a future book,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm giving the working title Forbidden Archaeology 2.
Okay.
But it might come out under another title
mm-hmm.
when it actually does come out. I can mention some other of the cases.
Uh-huh.
You know, for example, some German archaeologists, they discovered some very well-made wooden spears at a place called Schöningen in northern Germany.
Okay.
And these were spears shaped like a modern Olympic javelin. They were obviously weapons that were made for throwing and killing animals and things like that. And along with these spears, butchered animal bones were also found.
Mm-hmm.
And these things were found in layers of rock about 430,000 years old in northern Germany.
Hmm.
So this was a discovery that was published in 1995, 2 years after Forbidden Archaeology was published.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this is interesting. How are they going to explain that? So what they proposed is kind of interesting. They proposed that the spears must have been made by the ape man, Homo erectus.
Okay.
It couldn't have been human beings like us because we didn't exist then.
Mm-hmm.
Who was existing? The ape man Homo erectus was existing, so that's who must have made them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was really kind of an interesting development in archaeology because before this discovery, nobody had ever proposed that Homo erectus was hunting like that with these spears, throwing them, killing animals, things. Before this discovery, most archaeologists believe only humans like us have the intelligence to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the oldest spears that they had at that point were less than 100,000 years old. And so they fit within the modern human time range. So when they made this new discovery, of course, they didn't want to extend the modern human time range back 430,000 years. That would have messed up their whole theory. But they thought, well, the only evidence that we have from Europe is that Homo erectus, this ape-man Homo erectus, was there. But it's not true that that's the only evidence that they had. In the 19th century, there was a French archaeologist named Jacques Boucher de Perthes. He made some interesting discoveries at a place called Abbeville in northeastern France. And he found a human jawbone, an anatomically modern human jawbone, in some very ancient layers of rock that modern geologists believe are about 430,000 years old. And he found this human jawbone with many stone tools and weapons. So he reported this to the scientific world, but most scientists at that time didn't believe that humans could have existed so far in the past. So they proposed, well, here's what probably happened. Somebody must have gone to some nearby Roman cemetery and gotten a human jaw from the Roman cemetery, just maybe 2,000 years old, and then they went and dug a hole in the ground and planted that bone for the archaeologists to find. It's a very ancient layer of rock. And that's the story you see in most textbooks today about this discovery. But what we don't read in the textbooks is that when Jacques Boucher de Perthes was accused like this, he went to the same region, and he made additional excavations that were witnessed by many professional scientists and medical doctors under conditions that completely ruled out this hoax hypothesis. And in these new excavations, he found 100 additional anatomically modern human bones and teeth in the same layers that are about 430,000 years old. So what I'm proposing is, well, there is evidence that humans like us were existing 430,000 years ago in northern Europe. So I would say it's perfectly justifiable to say that the spears found by the German archaeologists of 1995 were made by humans like us existing in northern Europe. So this is one of the cases that I'll be including in my book. It's just more evidence that human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints older than the current evolutionary theory allows have been found, are being found, will continue to be found.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes. One thing I wanted to touch on, we have, of course, you know, all different religions out there, and I want to try to you know, respect everyone's right. Of course, as you were pointing out, a lot of the opinions of current science could be certainly be said to be in the realm of religion and dogma. Okay, but I guess maybe, okay, people that are in the Christian faith and they take a Bible as literal, and, you know, there was one with a good bit of thing I covered with the autobiography of a yogi I thought was very interesting, because it explained, you know, that Genesis and is deeply symbolic, a lot of allegorical stories going on, and then I guess maybe try to, you know, the thought some people will say that, you know, the literal, trying to their interpretation of Genesis being literal, that the earth is only a few thousand years old, maybe say 5,000 to 6,000 years old, and then they have some type of thing for the explanation of maybe carbon dating is that it doesn't really work or something like that. So maybe, I guess, what might, and of course this is probably a whole other 2-hour subject in a sense, but maybe speak to people that would say, because see, here now we're doing both. You're presenting that this is intelligent design with an intelligent creator, but that also is very, very, we're dealing with years and ages that are fantastically old, you know, hundreds of millions of years old.
Right.
So, but what would your response to someone who is, you know, is trying to explain to themselves, you know, this is a creator created the world, but that it's very young? Do you know what the, you know?
Yes,
what I mean?
I do. Now, as anybody who reads my books know, I've gotten some inspiration from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which talk about a very old earth.
Mm-hmm.
But even among Christian creationists, there are young earth creationists,
mm-hmm,
who believe the earth is maybe 5,000 or 10,000 years old, and they would have a lot of problems with the different dating methods,
mm-hmm,
that establish older ages. But then even among Christian creationists, there are some old earth Christian creationists who,
mm-hmm,
accept on the basis of certain statements in the Bible that the days of Genesis are, sometimes they quote some statement from the Bible that says, of the Lord, his day is like 1,000 of our years or something,
yes,
like that. So some of them would, even reading literally, would take the days as being days of the Lord, and those days are very long,
mm-hmm,
and that would give an older age for the earth.
Very
now,
good.
I'm not going to try to say who's right,
mm-hmm,
about that,
mm-hmm,
because as I mentioned throughout the program, I even respect the right of evolutionists,
mm-hmm,
to believe what they want to believe and try to convince others, but I don't think they have a right to dictate to others,
exactly,
you know, what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
If people choose to agree with them, let them believe, but I don't think they should have a government-enforced monopoly in the education system.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So similarly, I would respect the right of anyone, a young Earth creationist, old Earth creationist, or whatever, to believe what they want to believe, to justify their belief in terms of scientific evidence,
mm-hmm,
but I don't think they have a right to dictate through some government-enforced monopoly,
mm-hmm,
what everybody should believe.
Yes.
You know. But actually, when my book first came out, my book Forbidden Archaeology first came out, it got a very good review in Creation Research Quarterly,
okay,
which is the main journal of the Young Earth Christian Creationists. Actually, they reviewed the abridged edition of the book called The Hidden History of the Human Race.
Okay.
Because Forbidden Archaeology is 900 pages long.
Yes.
The Hidden History of the Human Race is about 300 pages.
Okay.
They gave it a very good review. Now, I think the reason they did that is because, although we may disagree,
mm-hmm,
about the age of the Earth, we agree on the fact that human beings have been present since the beginning,
mm-hmm,
and did not evolve from apes.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, in my relationship with young Earth creationists, I tell them whether we believe the Earth is a few billion years old or a few thousand years old, humans have been there since the beginning, and they,
mm-hmm,
didn't evolve from apes.
Mm-hmm.
At least we can agree on that much.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps later we'll have to have a discussion about the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. So how accurate is carbon dating? Can that be considered to be an actual...
Well, if you ask me,
okay,
and probably maybe I'm don't have, you know, because of my beliefs about the age of the Earth, maybe I'm not as motivated as somebody else might be to call it into question.
Mm-hmm.
But I tend to believe that it's based on a sound scientific principle, namely the known half-lives of various radioactive elements.
Mm-hmm.
The radiocarbon method is, you know, based on the idea that living things contain two types of carbon, carbon-12, which is not radioactive,
mm-hmm.
and carbon-14, which is radioactive. If it's radioactive, that means that it decays into other elements, so that gradually over time in a living thing, the amount of carbon-12 will remain the same, but the amount of carbon-14 will gradually decrease by half-lives of about 5,000 years. That means every 5,000, if you have 1 ounce to start out with, then after 5,000 years, the amount will go down to half an ounce.
Uh-huh.
After another 5,000 years, it'll go down to a quarter of an ounce. Another 5,000 years, it'll go down to an eighth of an ounce. And if you go back to about 100,000 years, finally there won't be enough carbon-14 left to measure.
Mm-hmm.
So that method is used for things that would be less than 100,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some critics will say, well, maybe as the half-lives are bigger than we think, you know, that it would disappear more rapidly or something. To me, the scientific observations tend to suggest that the half-life is known, and therefore it is an accurate method for dating, but there can be problems with any individual date because of contamination of samples with recent carbon-14. Let's say you have a human bone that's really 5 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
If it has the least amount of carbon-14 in it, that could come from bacteria or organic preservatives or that the bone was treated with, then even though the bone is really 5 million years old, it will show a carbon age of less than 100,000 years.
Hmm.
So this is a problem of contamination
mm-hmm.
in these methods. But I respect the right of those who believe in a young Earth to question the scientific basis of the carbon-14 method, which means they would have to dispute the half-life
mm-hmm.
of that radioactive element. They would have to show that it decays at a far faster rate
mm-hmm.
Than it actually does, that it has a half-life of far less, you know, maybe it has a half-life of 100 years. That means it would be gone very, very quickly, you know,
mm-hmm.
So that its ages would only go back about 5,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as I can see, these dating methods are based on sound scientific principles, the known rates of decay of radioactive elements, and therefore I'm prepared to accept them, but with this qualification, that in any particular use of a dating method, it could be wrong mm-hmm. through a contamination of samples, through mistakes that were made in applying the method, and things like that.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you taking out your time, Michael A. Cremo, co-author with Richard L. Thompson, the book Forbidden Archaeology, your website, mcremo, mcremo.com. And we'll be looking forward to Forbidden Archaeology Part 2, I guess, as you have it tentatively named.
That's the working title.
Yeah. Okay. All right, sir. Well, thank you very much. And
well, thank you, Doug.
If we want to talk again, we'll chat again.
That would be fine with me.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. All right, bye. Okay, WSHC, Shepherdstown. And I do believe, I don't think, super. Hopefully, is the building. I don't know if the building is opened. Ah, that must be them. Okay, well, get ready for Super Loose. And you had something out of that.